Good morning. This is Friday morning, Sunstone 2008, session 212. I'm Jake Zollinger, the chair for the session. I'd like to remind you before we begin, show your badge at the door, turn off your phones, be real nice and quiet. Our presenter today is Richard C. Russell. The title of his talk is Three Real Dangers to LDS Members. Richard is a man of many accomplishments. Has a master's degree in education. He's a retired instructor from the church education system, vice president of a business training and consulting firm. He's been a major in the U.S. Army Reserve and 38 years with the Boy Scouts of America, having received the Silver Beaver Award in 1986. He's a leader in a national service club called Leader Door.
That's the book.
That's the book. I'm sorry. Can't read his writing. He doesn't write very well for all those accomplishments.
I should have been a doctor.
He's a leader and member of an amateur performing group called the Babcock Performing Readers. He's the president of that club. He belongs to a service organization called the Exchange Club. He's been the district president, distinguished district secretary, and exchangeite of the year. So after he shares his talk, we'll have a response from Albert Peck. Everybody already knows Albert, so I won't waste any time introducing him. We all enjoyed his editorials and the issues of the magazine he organized for many years. He is the former editor of Sunstone. He now works for the editorial department of the Salt Lake Tribune. If you need to get an editorial published, it helps to be from Sunstone. It kind of gives you a little edge. So I'm going to turn the time over to Richard Russell for about a half hour, whatever he needs, and then Albert will give remarks and whatever's left. We'll use this microphone for questions.
Thank you, Jake.
Welcome to the hottest venue on the ticket today. Must be 90 degrees in here.
You want me to prop the door open here?
If it'll help circulation, I'll go for anything. I'm suffering.
Go ahead.
Before I proceed, if anyone has need of a banquet ticket for tomorrow night, please see me afterward. In 1993, Webb K. Packer told the All Church Coordinating Council, "There are three areas where members of the church influenced by social and political unrest are being caught up and led away. I chose these three because they have made major invasions into the membership of the church. In each, the temptation is for us to turn about and face the wrong way. It's hard to resist, for doing it seems so reasonable and right. The dangers I speak of come from the gay-lesbian movement, the feminist movement, and the ever-present challenge from the so-called scholars or intellectuals. Now, in my opinion, these challenges continue in the 15 years since first listed and will eventually change the church that Elder Packer knows. You will likely not live to see it. When gays and lesbians receive equal rights civilly and can legally marry, their status in the church will likely change, much like the status of black members changed at one time. When women eventually can hold the priesthood in almost every other Christian denomination, their status in the church might change too, changing the church for all time. When the church is no longer wary of confronting its own history in the work of objective scholarship, it will do what many organizations have done, such as the Community of Christ and the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Harold Bloom, last year's Frontline American Experience documentary, The Mormons, noted that such is necessary for any organization to survive. And in today's age of the Internet, World Wide Web, it's hard to control information anymore, and it's just going to change the church. Now, while these challenges relentlessly persist, they present no real danger or threat to the organization. President Packer asserted that these dangers would lead members to face the wrong way. I'm not sure what he meant, but I do not think they have the potential. I do think they have the potential of frustrating thoughtful members and of raising questions and doubts. Plural marriage and the priesthood ban were real threats to both the church and its members until new revelation eliminated the challenges. I believe there are three real dangers to members in 2008. They've been an integral part of the church for quite some time. They are certainty, literalism, and unwavering obedience to leaders. By certainty, I mean the unshakable conviction that typified by the phrase, "I know." The use of testimony to neutralize opposing views and the false sense of power imparts to the insecure in an uncertain world. By literalism, you can't read the label on that. For the listening audience, I have a slide on the screen of a Bible with a disclaimer sticker on it. Let me see if I can read it. Do not take it literally. Warning, contains, can't read myself.
Verses descriptive or advocating suicide, incest, bestiality,
masochism,
sexual activity in a simping context, murder, morbid violence.
Drugs and stuff. Okay, so anyway, the slide says don't take this book literally because it takes all this stuff. And I learned that from my teaching career, that it's full of stuff. Some good stuff and some strange stuff. If you take it literally, it becomes very strange. By literalism, I mean the dictionary definition with regard to content of the standard works for the rest of the world of the Bible. Strict adherence to the basic or primary meaning of a word or text, or adherence to the explicit sense of a given text or doctrine. By unwavering obedience to leaders, I mean the mainstream but unfounded notions that leaders do not make mistakes, but that if they do, obeying them anyway will be rewarded with blessings. Disobeying a church leader constitutes disobedience to God and represents failing to sustain them. Well, now, the three dangers can and frequently do reinforce each other. A general authority may take a literalistic position. I know, what are the odds again for that? With regard to his interpretation of a passage of Scripture, a member's loyalty to authority induces her to a certain point to be certain about that view. Disagreement is unthinkable because we accept certainty, literalism, and loyalty as a very Mormon worldview. Now, I'll assume, before I proceed, that logic and fact have primacy here in this discussion. I'll also emphasize that these dangers I list are by no means universal or ubiquitous. Now, certainty is a danger because it's prideful. Hey, I know it! I'm right, and you are wrong. It can be very empowering. I have a friend who has lost that certainty, and it's one of the things he misses most about his days of certainty was that it just gave him a huge ego stroking to be able to say that to people. He can no longer say it about much of anything anymore. The cartoon on the screen says, "Hey, I see here that this proves that I'm right about everything." Well, now, Paul was less certain. In 1 Corinthians 13:12, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known." In the new unified translation in Germany, which the church uses, it translates, "Now we look in a mirror and see only mysterious outlines or contours." The New English Version, a New International Version, "Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror." Now, the King James Version translated, the Greek isoptron for looking glass as glass. Most others use the word mirror. The only mirror of the day was a polished metal one. So how else are you going to see not an absolutely isometrically congruent representation of your face in such a medium? Other translators use the words dimly, indistinctly, blurred, obscured, or cloudy. Doesn't sound very certain to me. Certainty is a danger because it discourages further inquiry. We have here a Born Again. This is a Bagley cartoon. The boat is sinking from national debt, global warming, political corruption, Iraq war, poverty, and the Born Again is saying, me, I'm waiting for the rapture. Everybody else is trying to bail the sinking ship. He's very certain. The spirit of scientific inquiry becomes the hero's badge when it puts gas in our cars, food in our tables, or vaccines in our veins, but it becomes the mark of a scoundrel when it asks about the myths we call religion. I may or may not reveal the identity of that quote, the smiling cynic. We'll leave it at that for now. One of religion's criticisms of science is that it's always changing, as if that were some weakness of the discipline. Only one deeply committed to certainty would level such a criticism. The smiling cynic says again, an unchanging belief most likely suggests enforcement rather than truth. He says again, and he gets really, well, he's a cynic. I do not know a religion that is practiced as true to these necessities of the intellect. Never require or forbid a direction of inquiry, never specify or omit an answer before inquiry begins, and never embrace an answer as absolute even after inquiry finds one. Well, very few things in life are certain. I am certain about that. I discovered it almost most starkly by becoming a parent. Before I had children, I had 4 theories of effective child rearing. Now I have 4 children and no theories of effective child rearing. Our love affair with certainty, like all others, is strewn with the seeds of disappointment. Some degree of uncertainty is the only thing we can be sure of. Voltaire said, doubt is not a pleasant condition, but certainty is absurd. The ancients put it this way, according to Hubie Brown in an address to BYU in 1958. From the cowardice that shrinks from new truth, from the laziness that is content with half-truth, from the arrogance that thinks it has all truth, O God of truth, deliver us. Eric Fromm, the quest for certainty blocks the search for meaning. Uncertainty is the very condition to impel man to unfold his powers. Vaclav Havel, hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It's not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something makes sense, regardless of how it turns out. Certainty is a danger because it relieves responsibility. Well, that didn't tickle your funny bone like it did mine. Okay, that's all right. 2 cavemen are saying, think about it, all this inter-tribal violence, volcanoes, earthquakes, asteroids, tar pits, getting eaten by dinosaurs, it's the end times, my friend. We relish our stereotypes, for they remove both uncertainty and responsibility from our judgments. In a world so full of subtle complexities, we can still be certain that our neighbor is an idiot, and we can be free of responsibility for the judgment so long as he wears a silly tie, or even better, so long as he doesn't attend our church. Now, in my experience, one can be certain about a spiritual or mystical experience. That is, you can be certain you had it. It might be very emotional even, but uncertain about what it means. And that's been my problem all along. I'm continue to have profound spiritual experiences, but I don't always know what truth to derive from them, deduce from them. As Diderot also said, only a very bad theologian would confuse the certainty that follows revelation with the truths that are revealed. They're entirely different things. I submit that certainty based on a subjective feeling is most uncertain. Certainty about things that are inherently very uncertain because no objective evidence exists is irrational. Doesn't mean you can't believe in them, but believing in them with certainty is the problem. Believe what you will, and for whatever reason you have. We all do it, but certainty about it is a question. Certainty about metaphysical ideas or notions of future events or states of being is just simply unjustified. We're not there yet. We don't know. And nobody's returned from that time to tell us exactly what it's like. Robert Greene Ingersoll from the two centuries ago, "I will not attack your doctrines nor your creeds if they accord liberty to me. If they hold thought to be dangerous, if they aver that doubt is a crime, then I attack them one and all because they enslave the minds of men." Certainty is a danger because it leads to dogmatism. Man is at the door looking at a pamphlet. Two men dressed in white shirts and ties. He says, "This pamphlet's blank." And they say, "We're atheists." Now, let me ask you to respond with your hand raised if you know someone in the church who holds one or more of these views. "The things I believe are so completely true I could never doubt them. My opinions and beliefs fit together perfectly to make a crystal clear picture of things. There are no discoveries or facts that could possibly make me change my mind about the things that matter most in life. I'm absolutely certain that my ideas about the fundamental issues in life are correct." Raise your hand if you know somebody. Keep it up if they believe all of those. Keep it up if you know a lot who believe that way. Okay.
This
now,
is getting so personal.
I know. I apologize. It's. I'm treading on toes. I know that. Or, do you know someone in the church who holds one or more of these views? All of them are many or few. "There are many things we have not discovered yet. Nobody should be absolutely certain his beliefs are right. It is best to be open to all possibilities and ready to reevaluate all your beliefs. Flexibility is a real virtue in thinking, since you may well be wrong. I'm a long way from reaching final conclusions about the central issues in life." Raise your hand if you know anybody who holds that. All of them? Fewer hands. Lots or many who hold that? Yeah, all hands go down. See, that's why I say it's a danger. Certainty is a danger because it causes those not certain to wrongly believe themselves unworthy outsiders who do not belong, or even wicked with some unresolved sin lurking in their past. Not everyone, but some. That any should be made to feel unwelcome in the society because of certainty is a mistake, I believe. In addition, those certain regard them in that way, even if they themselves do not. This could lead to dishonesty or duplicity. Okay. Well, thanks for the courtesy laugh. Yeah, there we go. That's better. They all read it. No time to go over that for the listening audience. Some of you know Sean McCraney. He's cable access TV personality, former Mormon, wrote a book, "I Was a Born-Again Mormon, Moving Toward Christian Authenticity." I got this from page 64 in a review of his book, where he addresses uncertainty. It's a terrifying place to be. And because most people instinctively understand this principle, they spend an awful lot of time making sure they can be sure. Latter-day Saints are no different, and though the price I've personally paid for my willingness to embrace uncertainty has been enormous and extremely painful for everyone involved, it was necessary in light of my nature to test all things and discover for myself where absolute truth existed. Now, that last line is sort of ironic, isn't it? He says he's looking for the absolute truths. Well, you can't find absolute truths and retain uncertainty. Then you've got certainty if you think you have an absolute truth. Well, interesting. He can't shed that desire to search to be sure about being sure. Well, what became of Bruce R. McConkie's certainty regarding blacks in the priesthood, or Brigham Young's, for that matter? Or what of Wilford Woodruff's certainty regarding the second coming of the Lord in 1890? or Markey Peterson's views of interracial marriage, which he published in the same church news where the church released gave its press release on the priesthood ban being lifted, 1978. His editorial was about interracial marriage, which he was dead set against. Well, religious certainty is an adaptive act of self-deception in the face of rapid change under conditions of modernity. Reality has this way of knocking over all our little icons of belief. Now, that's the thing about both science and revealed religion, which we profess to believe in. Some, if not most, of our notions are going to be overturned by new light and knowledge. That's the nature of this beast. Change is so unpleasant for some, they cling to their lifesaver of certainty. So here's the reasons why certainty is a danger. Moving quickly on to literalism. It's a danger because it leads to preference to accept the first right answer to interpret a text. See? Okay, sorry, you can't read it. Man is sitting in his easy chair with his remote, talking to his wife. My doctor told me to start my exercise program very gradually. Today I drove past a store that sells sweatpants. Literalism is a danger because it can lead to the skeptical rejection of figurative, symbolic, or metaphorically rich possibilities. For the listening audience, since everybody can't read this, Santa's sexual harassment trial takes a dramatic change for the worse. I'll ask you again, sir, did you or did you not look at my client and in a crowded shopping mall in front of her children called her not once but three times a hoe? Literalism's a danger because it can lead to incorrect applications of those texts. Daryl is holding his spoon upside down above a bowl of soup. He suspected someone had once again slipped him a trick spoon with the concave side reversed. Now, the easiest examples of problems with literalism come from the Old Testament. They're still deeply entwined in our doctrine. The creation, Adam and Eve, no death before the fall, no atonement. If no fall, Adam is the first flesh, Noah's flood, and whether by the voice of my servants, by my voice or the voice of my servants, it's the same. The pre-1990 Temple Endowment presents this disclaimer. I hope we're not treading on any toes with revealing a line that's no longer hasn't been there for 18 years. With regard to the six creative periods, quote, this, however, is simply figurative so far as the man and woman are concerned. That this has been removed raises even more questions. It's a literalistic problem, and I submit it's a danger. Is it necessary in my walk with God for there to have been a real Adam and Eve? Can I learn from them as a parable or an allegory? Or must they have been real? Most of us reject the idea that Eve was fashioned from one of Adam's ribs. We generally take that as a figurative and symbolic. Some former leaders and many current members took the two trees to be literal. Now, we haven't had time to investigate those possibilities. That's a paper for maybe next year about the two trees. I'm going to submit that. In Science Magazine, maybe 10 or more years ago, a lecturer, an instructor at a college, reported that this happened to him almost every semester. He would ask what differences one would expect to see between the skeleton of a man and the skeleton of a woman. Every semester, someone said that the female skeleton would have one more rib than the male one. He offered to let them count on the specimens at the back of the room. The students usually declined, since by the Bible they already knew what the outcome would be. This is literalism coupled with certainty and no interest in further inquiry. You're already certain. You don't need to go find out what's real, what the facts are. Well, the LDS view that the earth was literally baptized by immersion, by Noah's global flood, and will be baptized by fire raises other theological questions. If you want to take it literally, then let's look at all the literal implications. Can the earth sin such that it needs to be forgiven? Or is it like Jesus and just going through the forms? I don't know. Will the earth's baptism by fire proceed along the same lines as ours, that is, by laying on of hands? We get baptized in water. The earth was baptized in water. Are the laying on of hands going to be the same? Was the earth's baptism a priesthood ordinance necessary for salvation? Or perhaps a type? Oh, excuse me. Will the earth receive a gift of the Holy Ghost? I've skipped a line in my paper. Sorry. The other three questions is asked, will the earth be thus born again? Does the earth become a member of the church? Was the earth's baptism a priesthood ordinance necessary for salvation? Well, the scriptures contain accounts that are contrary to modern knowledge. The flood was covered adequately in a Sunstone issue of 2004 by, was it Dwayne Jeffries?
Yeah.
It was a wonderful article, and we don't need to go into those details. I just asked these theological questions, too. The only rational response to them is to refrain from literalistic interpretations and turn to metaphorical, figurative, or symbolic meanings, thus preserving the moral authority and spiritual origins of our sacred texts. For example, let's take the flood and see that this is just the first example of the Lord leading his people away from gross wickedness to a place of safety and righteousness. We don't have to have a global flood for that to be the case. He did it five more times in our scriptures. Jared, Abraham, Moses, Lehi, and Brigham Young. Now, that's something we can use. That's a metaphorical meaning that doesn't have to make it literal. Now, in the Washington Times of June 24th, it was reported that compared to other faith traditions, Mormons may not be as literalist as heretofore presumed. Doesn't mean it's still not a danger and that it exists in the church. It's just not as bad as in other places. But blacks, historically black churches and evangelical Christians said the Bible should be interpreted literally, while majorities of Mormons, Catholics, and mainline Protestants said it should not. Well, I'm indebted to my first CES boss, Grant Hardy. If you ever knew him, you know what a prince of a man he was. For this interesting take on interpreting scripture, I attended the outstanding session yesterday about making the scriptures more meaningful, and they addressed things like this. But this is a handy way to remember an approach. Black, white, and green. Black is the ink. The words themselves on the page, they are abstractions for what they represent. We try to give and receive meaning in their use. What they say is for all to see. We always have the problem of translation, but we hope we have an accurate rendering. Literalists usually stop here. White is the space between the letters, words, lines, sentences, and paragraphs. It's not what is said. It is what is not said. For example, in John 13:35, by this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye keep the word of wisdom. No, that's not what he said. If ye pay tithing, not there. Attend your meetings, magnify your callings, keep dress standards, go to the temple, refrain from tats and body piercing, sustain and obey your leaders. No, he said, if ye have love one to another. That's what he said. While many people in many faith traditions substitute these other measures of what constitutes a true disciple of Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ defines it himself in Scripture, and we don't see it because I don't know why. But he didn't say these other things. That's important. That's the white. The green is for growth, for application, for what it means to me in my life. It can give hope, confidence, or faith, or their counterfeit. Reading the Word of Wisdom can make me a fanatic food faddist, or worse, a vegan. No, excuse me. I meant that totally in jest, honestly. I can approach the substances in my environment with moderation, knowledge, and facts, and logic. It's there for me to learn to apply my own way. A myth is a story that's true. Unless you insist that it be factual, then it's a lie. But we learn from our myths, the stories we tell about ourselves and about our forebears and about our ancestors and about the ancients. It's who we are, and it doesn't necessarily literally have to be true. Now, I'm going to skip this next section because I'm out of time. I already gave it 3 years ago, in 2005, and that's not what it says. It was an example of mistaken interpretation of section 1, verse 38, by my voice or voice of my servant to say. So we're going to skip ahead. Sorry. Literalism is a danger because it picks cherries. Man has got a vacuum rental store that he calls You Suck, and he wonders why the parking lot is empty. What am I doing wrong? Those are the reasons literalism is a danger. Now let's turn to unwavering obedience to leaders. Make that qualification. Unwavering obedience to God is not a question. Now it's dangerous. Oh, this is very difficult for them to see. But so whatever animal that is, I'm not even familiar with this cartoon strip, but the animal buddy of this little person who's building an ice fort. So you'll only talk to people who sign an oath of loyalty to you? Yep, life's too short to deal with malcontents. Well, sitting around and listening to people undermine your core beliefs with facts and stuff can only lead to one thing. The little animal says, learning? No, silly, anarchy. Unwavering obedience is dangerous because it tends to foster an unhealthy culture of hero worship. Near celebrity status of general authorities can distract one from the central figure of the Savior, and it promotes the mentality that leads to abuses of power, well known in authoritarian settings. Let's see. Yeah. Sorry about that. We have to go back. Well, let's just leave it there. No, we're in the right place. The smiling cynic said, breaking the rules because they are the rules is as bad as keeping the rules because they are the rules. Obedience and rebellion are just opposite sides of the same silly coin of control. Well, unwavering obedience is further dangerous because it tends to foster an unhealthy culture of hero worship. Einstein in therapy. As a child, I could never obey my father when he said, don't get smart with me. Celebrity status of authorities. Now, not all of these cartoons fit, but they're meant to lighten the temper the smiling cynic's cynical comments. This has been a test of the emergency broadcast system. This was only a test, and there's Superman saying, damn, ruined another shirt. That can distract the central figure, the Savior. This has nothing to do with that statement, but I thought it was a cute idea of obeying leaders who don't know what they're doing. And this says, why computer engineers are not surgeons? Let's shut down all his bodily functions and start him up again. Well, I have just a few minutes left to talk about the Milgram experiment. Now, raise your hand if I need to give a little detail about the Milgram experiment. Okay, I'll read quickly. This appeared in the Issues in Ethics, Winter of 88. And these are excerpts from that article. Since the Nazi atrocities toward the Jews were discovered at the end of World War II, people have wondered how many could have engaged in such obviously unconscionable behaviors. The death camps in which Jews were systematically tortured and killed were efficiently organized, managed by well-trained administrative personnel. These administrators were not extraordinarily vicious savages run amok. On the contrary, the Germans who ran the death camp seemed to be ordinary, decent citizens with consciences no different from those of any of us. How could they have blinded themselves to the clear injustice of what they were doing? More generally, what motivates the unethical acts of ordinary, decent people? Perhaps one of the most fascinating experiences was one conducted by Stanley Milgram, the psychologist, who devised this experiment. Subjects in this experiment were told that they were going to take part in exercises designed to test other people's abilities to learn. They were seated at a mock shock generator with 30 switches marked from 15 volts, slight, to 450 volts, danger, severe. Through a small glass window, they could see the learner, quote-unquote, in the adjoining room strapped to a chair with electrodes on his wrists. The subject was told he was to test the other person's ability to memorize lists of words and to administer a shock when the learner made a mistake, increasing the intensity each time a mistake was made. As the intensity of the shocks grew, the learner pretended to cry out more and more pain, eventually fainting. The experimenter told the subjects they had to continue administering the shocks. Astonishingly, although the subjects grew nervous and agitated, more than two-thirds administered the highest level of shocks to the learners when ordered to do so by the experimenter. Milgram concluded that when people are ordered to do something by someone they view in authority, most will obey, even when doing so violates their consciences. It's been repeated dozens of times in many different groups of people. The results are always the same. However, although his findings are disturbing, my more recent research has suggested that obedience to authority over conscience is not inevitable. Indeed, this research of Stephen Sherman, also a psychologist, suggests that education can strengthen the power of conscience over authority. Sherman had a colleague contact several people by telephone, ostensibly to poll them on their opinions. The pollster asked them what they would do if they were ever ordered to perform a certain act that was morally or socially undesirable, and spent some time discussing the issues with them over the phone. Several weeks after that contact was made, these same people were actually asked to carry out that act. Surprisingly, two-thirds refused to obey the order. A sharp contrast to Milgram's finding that two-thirds of those ordered to act against their conscience would normally obey. The implication of the Sherman experiment is that if people reflect on a moral issue before they are involved, they're more likely to behave in accordance with their consciences when that issue faces them in real life. Moral reflection and discussion of the kind found in the test types of moral education substantially enhance the ethical quality of a person's future choices. What does that say about the content of our church curriculum? Well, we're told to think about the issues. No, we're told to obey. Now, unwavering obedience is dangerous because it promotes the mentality that leads to abuses of power, and mother's power is the most powerful. Here's the triage nurse, and one door is underwear, clean underwear, and the other door says dirty underwear. You were told to wear clean underwear in case you got an accident. Remember that? Yeah. Well, this is the authority of the mother is supreme. It empowers. Unwavering obedience is dangerous because it empowers and attracts the types to look for power in order to wield it. The strong emphasis on obeying and ever questioning leaders keeps them protected in their unrighteous dominion. We're warned about unrighteous dominion, but we're not told how to avoid it. I do not need to be told to obey someone whom I love and know without question loves me. That's why it's easy to obey God. I wonder why they keep telling us that we need to. That's a question right by itself. Unwavering obedience is dangerous because it further attracts those who want to be told what to do. There's no fool like an old fool, Haystack, but some of you young fellows show real promise. Smiling cynic said, "Those people who don't like to be responsible for their choices are among those who love to obey." Let me take 3 minutes to talk about Bob Altemeyer, the associate professor, Department of Psychology, University of Manitoba, Winnipeg, Canada. He did some research in authoritarianism and wrote a book that he's got online free. If you just Google his name and the authoritarians, you will find his free download of a PDF of his entire book. I have excerpted a few things. Let me just read a bit. Authoritarians And these are definite groups of people you can determine by a little test he's got in his book. Authoritarian followers usually support the established authorities in their society, such as government officials and traditional religious leaders. Such people have historically been the proper authorities in life, the time-honored, entitled customary leaders, and that means a lot to the most authoritarians. Psychologically, these followers have personalities featuring, one, a high degree of submission to established legitimate authorities in their society. They have a propensity to do that in their personality. Two, high levels of aggression in the name of their authorities, and a high level of conventionalism. High authorities trusted President Nixon, for example, longer and stronger than most people did during the Watergate crisis. Some of them still believe Nixon was innocent of criminal acts, even when he accepted a pardon for them. Similarly, the Allies found many Germans in 1945 refused to believe that Hitler, one of the most evil men in history, had ordered the murder of millions of Jews and others. He was busy running the war, Hitler's apologist said. The concentration camps were built and run by subordinates without his knowing it. To pick a more current example, authoritarian followers believed more than most people did President George W. Bush's false claims that Saddam Hussein had extensive links to Al-Qaeda, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and they supported the invasion of Iraq, whereas less authoritarian Americans tended to doubt the wisdom of that war from the start. If someday George W. Bush is indicted for authorizing torture, you can bet your bottom dollar the high authoritarians will howl to the heavens in protest. It won't matter how extensive the torture was, how cruel and sickening it was, how many years it went on, how many prisoners died, how devious Bush was in trying to evade America's laws and traditional stand against torture, or how many treaties the U.S. broke. Why? Don't ask. No, I'm not asking. This is rhetorical. Why does Utah give G.W. Bush such a high approval rating, still the highest in the nation? And why do I say that unwavering obedience to leaders is dangerous? You determine that yourself. There are other problems with authoritarians. Let's skip to the very end. Oh, these are wonderful things, but we'll have to...
Can you do it?
No, I don't have time. Let's just go to the summary. And now, wait a minute, let's see. President Monson in 1963, he was newly called General Authority at BYU, October, who said, it was Harry Emerson Fosdick who said, men will work hard for money. They'll work harder for other men. But men will work hardest of all when they are dedicated to a cause. Until willingness overflows obligation, men fight as conscripts rather than following the flag as patriots. Duty is never worthily performed until it's performed by one who would gladly do more if only he could. We recall perhaps the closing scenes of Schindler's List, when Oskar Schindler broke down and wept because he hadn't done enough. I don't know if that really happened, but it's necessary in the telling of the story to show how thoroughly converted he had become. And the test is not how much more obedient he could have been, but how much more good he could have done. It's not in Paul's closing verse of chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians. It's not a now by the certainty literalism and obedience, these three, but the greatest of these is obedience, although many Mormons act as if that's what he said. He said, and now abideth faith, not certainty, hope, not literalism, charity, love, not obedience. Greatest of these is charity. If you're interested in getting a copy of this or the PowerPoint presentation, either one or both, let me know. Oh, well, I should put that back up just a second.
Well, enjoy the cartoon while it's here.
Oh, still playback. Oh, I touched that. Sorry.
There you go.
Okay, now be kind to me, Edward.
As most people in this room, my journey has traveled the well-worn path of these issues, and I find myself agreeing with almost everything he said, in emphasis, if not in their totality. And recently I pulled together a collection of the songs that influenced me most in my life, and Cole Porter's song Experiment, which champions an adventurous life of openness and trying and going with what you learn, based on the scientific method, is like on the top of my list. So those are kind of my disclaimers as I go on with this paper. I think literalism, certainty, and obedience, the dangers that Richard discusses are often rooted in fear. When we're afraid of something, and we resort to a literalist interpretation. And to the extent that we grow and mature and become an adult, and our fears decrease, and our love and charity and hope increase, then the dangers are mitigated. And there are virtues in all of these in these three topics that he discussed, and I really want to focus on the virtues, just as the respondent to give a counter tip. For I found Richard's presentation one-sided. It was really a legal brief discussing what the dangers were in each of these areas, but didn't discuss the complexity of living with each of these topics. For you never can get rid of literalism or the issues of obedience or certainty. Yes, the Apostle Paul did say that we see through a glass darkly, showing his humility and an attribute we should all model. But Paul himself was much more often an advocate and an exemplar of certainty. You know, he's the one who also said, "For if the trumpet give an uncertain sound, who shall prepare himself for the battle?" And Paul was adamant in his certain testimony of Jesus Christ and his resurrection. And he would brook no discussion on that. And he was adamant and certain in many of the other things he wrote in his epistles to people. You don't find Paul living that verse that you talked about. And which is probably true for most of us. But my friend Helen Whitney, who did that PBS documentary on Mormons, she found that the thing that troubled her most about Mormons was that their certainty. She said, "I know this. They say I know that. I know this." And being kind of from a New York secular world, that just really disturbed her. And because they didn't say I believe or I think or here's my best understanding, it was I know. Recently, that's been verified in the research that came out this year from the Pew Institute that was reported like a month ago, that Mormons have a high certainty in literalism compared to the rest of the country. Those are just fascinating statistics, which I don't have time to result. So while certainty has its dangers and dysfunctions, it also has its strengths. If it is prideful, it is also bold. If it discourages inquiry, it can be visionary. If it relieves responsibility, it can also call and motivate to action. If it leads to dogmatism, it also passes on the received truths from one generation to another generation, which is not a small thing. If it stigmatizes the uncertain, it protects the core truths. If Brigham Young's uncertainty about blacks and the priesthood and the timing of the Second Coming and a host of other topics today seems without foundation, he was certain about other things, about the prophetic call of Jesus Christ, about Joseph Smith, and about the building of Zion, which still calls and motivates to other people. And it's really hard to know when certainty is good and when it's not. You know, I think we need to have the self-critical analysis always going on that Richard talked about. But I don't know if we can have a functioning society without it. And certainty carries people through hard times and severe tribulations. If people weren't certain about the gospel and Joseph Smith, they wouldn't have walked across the plains or did what they did. Most leaders have a certainty that inspires, from parents who are certain about the moral values they teach their children to our national leaders. The stories of achievement and progress all have threads of certainty woven in them, which if you pulled those threads out, the tale would unravel. Of course, there are other threads too: openness, wonder, curiosity, experimentation. But certainty is the thread that is woven in. It's difficult sometimes to distinguish certainty from commitment, and we don't accomplish much without commitment. Augustine famously said, well, it's hard to know what to be certain about and what not, and then that leads to the famous Augustine quote: in the essentials, unity; in the non-essentials, liberty; and in all things, charity. But it's defining the essentials that are the problem. And while Richard allowed for lots of ambiguity, he was fairly certain about the existence of God and his action in the life. But for people who are scholars of the beginnings of Mormonism or Christianity, that's often a troubling matter, as you see more and more things being accounted for best by human explanation. My journey has made me less certain about most things, but there remains immutable points on which I am more and more dogmatic, even though I know that many of the things I'm dogmatic about are myths. We all live by myths that motivate and structure our life and give us purpose and meaning from our own personal, the myths about our personal life, the stories we tell ourselves. Is my story heroic? Am I a victim? Am I this? For instance, the notion that all humans are created politically equal is not, in fact, really provable, but it is something that I am more and more committed to in life. And I am committed to it because what flows from it is good. And while I'll have discussions with people about that issue, I'm pretty dogmatic and certain that we should treat everyone equal. And it's just not up for discussion. And that certainty is a good thing, I think. On to literalism. We live in a literal church. You know, you may wonder about the certainty of Adam and Eve's story in the creation and the fall. But thousands of Mormons every summer flock to Adam on Diamond. You know, and literalism has its upsides and downsides, as does certainty. I'm a connoisseur of close. Forget that paragraph because you didn't discuss that point. I'm most concerned with outcomes, and in Mormonism, the making of the figurative as literal has been powerful in creation of its peoplehood. We are not, or we were not, figuratively Israel. We believe we were literally Israel. We were. God's covenant is again with this people as it was in Old Testament and New Testament times. And the covenants and the promises and the being a separate people who God was working through, even to the extent as our blood being connected to them, was taken as a literal fact that motivated a lot of the early saints. Similarly, when we left Nauvoo, the saints were strung along a trail, a sorry trail, all the way across Iowa to winter quarters. And Brigham Young announced that we were no longer a church. The church had dissolved. We had become the camp of Israel, like Moses leading Israel in the camp. And that was a literal fact. But that imagery, which was just not figurative but literal, motivated people like, yes, we are. We will, like Israel, make it to the promised land. Let me see. Other things we can take figuratively but act as if they're literal are our notion of eternal family and that our families can be forever. Has great dysfunctions, as many papers here have presented over the years. And yet, that commitment to being sealed together forever as a couple, as a family, has flows from it many, many wonderful good things in the life, in our church. All language is metaphorical. And while Mormons have their dysfunctions with these issues, I think ultimately we are pretty sophisticated and practical in switching back and forth between literal and figurative readings when we need to. I think a good example is the word of wisdom. You know, if you take a literal reading of that, yeah, it's really quirky. It's an early 19th century health code that doesn't have much application to our understanding of health today. And yet, we take the issue of health figuratively. And I remember even as a missionary, the discussions I had to memorize, you turn a page and say, harmful drugs are also part of the word of wisdom. You know, they're not in the word of wisdom. And, but we say they are. And we focus on the points that actually make a difference, like smoking, and we ignore the more quirky parts. And when we need to be, we're pretty pragmatic people, and we're pretty skilled at going back and forth between the literal and the figurative. Of course, we always resort to the literal when we want to trump someone else. And you know, the scripture says this, and those words mean that, you know. All those points to me. On to obedience. A time-honored way of learning is by being a disciple, which the word discipline is connected to, which means following the master and doing what the master does. You discipline yourself by doing that. There are lots of other ways of learning, like the scientific method, but we shouldn't discount obedience as discipleship in terms of not blindly obeying, but obeying even if you don't know why sometimes. You can learn and you can grow, and there's a humility to it. And obedience stretches us. When the bishop comes and taps you on the shoulder and says, it's your turn to be scoutmaster, you know, it's a job you never wanted and would run from, but because you are obedient, you do it. And your life is immersed and intertwined with other people's, and your soul stretches and grows to a size it never could have been otherwise. And you're very grateful for it. Lots of souls in the church are stretched because they are obedient. And lots of things are accomplished because they're obedience. We don't like it sometimes, but we marvel at it when a dam breaks in Idaho and Mormons can mobilize a crowd of people overnight to help because we've got this obedience thing. We don't like it sometimes, but when the prophet gets a revelation to give blacks the priesthood, even people in the South salute and do it because of that virtue. And so there's good things about it. We march across the plains. We help that. Finally. Churches, I think the role of the individual is to individuate yourself from the issues of the church in terms of obedience, literalism, and certainty, to learn the lessons that Richard talks about. But the church is going to have to deal with those issues. It's the nature of a conservative organization, which is to carry these truths that we prize from generation to generation. Martin Marty wrote a book once called, a small book, called... Excuse me, it wasn't Martin Marty, it's Raymond E. Brown, the biblical scholar, Catholic biblical scholar, called The Churches That the Apostles Left Behind. And he looked at the different congregations of whose text we have in the Bible to see what issues they were talking about. The church that we love the most is the communities of the Apostle John, that produced the Gospel of John, which says that we should have the love of the, that love is the animating virtue of the community and of the individual, that we should all have the Spirit to motivate us and follow us. And yet, if we look at that, look at those communities in the epistles of John, we find them racked by division and falling apart. There are competing revelations. One person has the Spirit telling this, and another person has them telling this, and it's falling out, and the communities are warring and fighting because of that. And that theology, as much as you know you are my disciples because you have love for one another, really cannot sustain a community over time. The community that is sustained and perpetuated is the one that produced the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew is the only gospel in which the word church appears. And it's the gospel that focuses on commandments and obedience and doing. And it's the gospel that the Catholic Church inherits and produces it. If you want an organization that's going to provide structure, that's going to last through time and give meaning and purpose to people generations after generations, you're going to have a lot of certainty, obedience, and literalism in it. And we live in a church like that. And, you know, it's much easier than to develop strategies and wisdoms to be an authentic individual within those structures. Because it's... otherwise, we can have a liberal-based church and we'll hemorrhage like the liberal Protestants are, you know, or the community of Christ. So, those are my comments and our time's up.
I'm sorry, the time is up and other people need to use this room. So, we appreciate these speakers and this will be the end of our session.
Okay.